Okay, thanks. Thanks everybody for being here today. I want to also thank Mark and the GLRC for working with us to make this happen, and for the great introduction. It sounds just like it, so that's good. And in fact, that's a point I want to make, because I was a industrial factory worker, and as I got started, I had left after high school to go work in the factory because my father worked there, and because I knew that it was a decent job. I thought I would do that for a few years, and then go to university and progress with my career that way. And so I had thought that this was a stunningly great move, and it was a move that was available to me, where I was able to go and get a pretty decent full-time job that carried benefits and pension, provided my father an income, my grandmother an income before him, provided me an income, it allowed me to buy a house when I was 19. And I used to tell people I was the last generation who could probably get a decent job out of high school, and unfortunately, as things have turned out, folks, it wasn't true. Because I got active with the union and ended up, through a series of adventures and misadventures, standing here before you today to do this. But the factory that I worked in was closed in 2007 after 100 years of operation. All of that was gone. None of that food that was produced in southwestern Ontario is produced there anymore. And so this is the reality that I would have faced then had I still been working at the plant. It's the reality I think that many people are experiencing, is those good full-time jobs don't exist anymore, or are increasingly shrinking, and what we're left with is the scenario of precarious part-time work, and how are we going to deal with that? So Angelo's correct, we had a very Canadian argument coming in today where it went something like, well, why don't you go first? No, that's okay, you can go first. You, please, go first. So having done that, Angelo, I think, has nicely set up some of the environment, and so has Stephanie, about some of the threats that exist. I think they're fairly well known amongst people about what's going on. So maybe what I'm going to do first is I'm just going to give you a little bit of information about UFCW and the operation of our local union. Then I want to get into a little bit about the benefits of being unionized, because one of the things I think that has successfully happened over the years through a whole variety of pretty devious things on the part of right-wing politicians and business is that there's been a really strong intent to devalue unions and what purpose they do. And so not many people, I think, are aware of some of the values of being unionized, where that was fairly well understood, like when I went to at the cannery. That was an understood benefit to being there, that if you're in a union, as Stephanie had said, a lot of our members now, particularly in grocery retail, come to work and don't know there's a union necessarily. Certainly didn't show up there because there was a union. Okay, so let me talk about UFCW Canada specifically, and Ontario in particular. So the United Food and Commercial Workers was a union that was started in 1979 through a merger of two unions, the Retail Clerks Union and the Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butchermen of America. In Canada, I will give you some specific numbers about our workers in grocery retail, because we represent grocery retail workers all across the country, and obviously as an international union, we do in the United States as well. But we have around 150,000 workers just in grocery retail settings. So that doesn't include the industrial units we have or the other forms of retail that we have, like pharmacy. That's strictly grocery retail. When we get to Ontario, there are essentially three large locals in Ontario, the UFCW, that have the majority of the grocery retail with us, and that's locals 175 and 633, where I work. Those two locals work together, so it's when you hear 175 and 633, we're talking about fundamentally the same operation in terms of those two locals, and then local 1006A. Between our three locals, we have just over 60,000 members in grocery retail alone across the entire province. So we have a fairly high, large density of grocery retail members in the province. And we're talking pretty much every major banner that you can imagine in grocery retail, obviously Loblaws and the sub-brands under that, between the Real Canadian Superstore, the Great Canadian Food Store, Zehrs, Fortino's, Your Independent Grocer, so on. Loblaws loves their banners and has many, many, many of them. The Metro Group, which now largely operates as Metro or Food Basics, as the discount grocery retailer, but as Angelo had indicated, there's some variations on that through a series of Metro acquiring different companies like AMP. There are some sub-collective agreements under that. We have some SOBEs, both in terms of having things like an actual SOBEs and a few Freshcos, their step-down sort of discount grocery retailer, and Foodlands as they operate. And then we have some uniques as well, things like Lococo's, which is a fairly unique brand in Hamilton that we also have got into. To give you a sense of the demographics of our members working in grocery retail, about 55% identify as female when we talk about that over 60,000. 57% are what we consider to be youth, which is age 30 or younger. And 82% are employed as part-time at those grocery stores. So distinctly, the industry has shifted to a part-time employment model. That is a change that we have seen develop over the years. If you look track back into 70s and 80s and move forward throughout time into the 90s into now, that number has grown immensely in terms of the amount of part-time jobs that are there. And as you already heard from Stephanie and Angelo on that, I'm not going to go into too much detail over those shifts, but that's a very real shift that's happened, and that's fundamentally where the retail industry is. Regardless of grocery retail, if you look at retail, it has become a part-time employment industry. So getting into some of the benefits of being unionized, I am going to get into some specifics of some of the achievements we've made in the last 2 years. But in general, I think some of the sort of more general provisions that maybe people like me who've been unionized my entire adult life take for granted, I don't know that get that much highlight anymore. And this includes things like we talk about the Employment Standards Act in Ontario and what it provides in terms of benefits. You know, we have 2 weeks, you get a maximum of 2 weeks of vacation in Ontario under the Employment Standards Act. Interesting to me, Ontario being only one of two jurisdictions in Canada that has that lower threshold, the other being the Yukon, for those of you who are wondering where the other one is. Our collective agreements provide frequently for a far greater benefit for vacation entitlement for part-time and full-time workers. So as you graduate 3 years of service, you get an increased entitlement not only to vacation time, but pay to go with that, which has a real value, which directly provides to the compensation package. All of our retail collective agreements provide benefits to the workers. And again, we pride ourselves, I think, as Canadians of the benefits that we have in terms of healthcare. But there's lots and lots of health benefits that we don't get that really fundamentally mean a lot to people. And we're talking about things like optical. If I didn't have an optical plan, I probably wouldn't have got here today because I'd still be walking into the wall, for instance. Dental is a major factor. There's major health benefits that come to that. And most of that, if you don't have a benefit plan, is not covered. Drug plans, increasingly a lot of medicine, modern medicine, is done through the provision of prescription drugs, and they're very expensive and getting more so. Angelo and I promised each other that we weren't going to talk about NAFTA and trade agreements today, but as we see increasingly these free trade agreements, we're getting more and more pressure about prescription drugs. That has a real fundamental cost to people because increasingly people's health care is provided through getting prescription drugs. So that means something very fundamental to people. And our collective agreements provide for benefit plans, including for part-time people. Now, I'm not going to tell you they're perfect, right? I'm not going to tell you that work at a unionized Food Basics and it's utopia, because I don't think any of you would believe me if I said that. But it is fundamentally better than the non-union alternative in a dramatic way, and I don't think people think about that. If you're a 16-year-old kid who wants to go work at a grocery store, you're probably not thinking about your drug plan and your optical plan and your benefit plans in general, and they have a fundamental value. You know, our collective agreements, as we have seen that things have gone to a part-time industry and that we have a very high percentage of youth going to these things, we understand that youth want to move to different locations, so we've been successful in negotiating transfer language in our big retail agreements where workers can transfer over to another store if they go to a university in a different community or a college in a different community and maintain their seniority, maintain their length of service for things like benefits and wage increase, and that's fundamentally a good thing too. As we talk about the engagement with our people and we talk about people's experiences with the union they have when they're in a grocery store, if they don't consider that to be their final job or their real job, these are things that have a value to people that maybe if they don't end up working in grocery retail full time, they can look back on and go, that was actually pretty good for me. I got to move, I got to maintain a job, I got to maintain my level of benefits. So I think that has a real value with respect to something in collective agreements. Overtime provisions is something that, I think people don't really consider that much. And for those of you who, say, read the Toronto Star, last year there was a series of articles talking about what happens to people in non-union settings in particular with respect to overtime, and that the enforcement of overtime provisions is frankly terrible in the province. There was recently an article that was put out in the Star where the Ministry of Labour did a blitz on previous offenders, and what they found was of those previous offenders, 77% of them were still offenders. And so, again, you know, we have these laws and we've negotiated this language for good purpose, and it's because there should be some kind of recognized threshold of what is acceptable for working hours, and if there is some overage of that, that there should be some premium for that. I think everybody understands that principle, but the fact that it's so abused, I don't know that people really get until they experience it, and they have to go through a 10-year-long complaint through the Ministry of Labour to get it. Whereas in our collective agreements, one of the key values to being unionized that Stephanie briefly touched on, and it is a shame, the key value is you have access to a grievance procedure that allows for fundamental enforcement of not only the minimum standards, the employment standards, but also the benefits in the collective agreements. It is a real functioning model of worker power, and it provides for a real legislative ability for workers to have a voice and have some power to challenge their employer, and that's extremely valuable. Again, most people I don't think appreciate it until they need it, until they've been fired for some, frankly, really ridiculous reason. If you're in a non-union store, that's it, good luck, find another job. If you're in one of our collective agreements, you can challenge that, and we do that. So to give you some sense of that too, in Local 175, we have had well over in the last few months 300 grievances relating to grocery retail locations, and about 56 arbitration hearings. So, you know, if we're not able to resolve agreements at the store level, which we are very successful in doing for the most part, the vast majority get resolved between us and the employer, working out solutions to it, then you go off to see a labor arbitrator. It's one of the provisions, one of the benefits we have under the law, at which point you can get a legally binding decision. And if you're not unionized, you don't have that. You can try to file a complaint through the ministry, or you can go and hire a lawyer if you had the money to do it. You don't have that. So, I mean, that's a real fundamental value in there. And again, it is unfortunate that, you know, you have to talk about that as a real value, because I think we all expect when you negotiate laws and you have laws and you set standards, we as a caring society should just expect that these things would happen. The reality is, it isn't. And I think this increasingly is the lived experience of people as industries have gone precarious and have gone part-time, is that people are really suffering out there for all kinds of different reasons. Getting into some of the good stuff, because we've heard a lot about the negative stuff, I think, and it is important also to talk about how we can succeed. Along with Unifor doing their metro deal, you heard Angela say that we're about to go into our mainline metro collective agreement in Local 175 this year, which has about 9,000 employees in it. We had our major round of Loblaw bargaining around the same period of time that Unifor was doing the metro agreement, and this was a very large set of bargaining that included all three of our local unions in Ontario. We negotiated together, and we got some real fundamental benefits. 82% of the workers are part-time. Scheduling becomes a big difficulty, and this, again, is something, and maybe Pam will be speaking to it when we get there, but you have some workplaces that aren't unionized where they don't know the next day where what their schedule is going to be or when they're going home, let alone get any kind of week's notice. And if you are a part-time worker, odds are pretty good that you're not a part-time worker in one place, you're a part-time worker in multiple places. And so having some forecast of scheduling becomes extremely important to you to be able to plan your life and to be able to run your life. And so we had some fairly major gains in the last round of Loblaw scheduling. We were able to negotiate language with the employer that puts out a 2-week schedule. So you get a week schedule that's firm, and you get a second week that is there that you have an idea of what it is. It can be slightly changed with some notice period, but having the ability to know what my life is like for the next 2 weeks is an extremely major benefit to our workers in the Loblaw collective agreements. We also were able to strengthen up the job guarantee language that we had in that collective agreement. So we have traditionally had job guarantees around full-time. You know, as we had started to see those jobs starting to shift in favor of part-time jobs, we sort of tried to run in and try to shore up the full-time positions we have. Well, in this last round of Loblaw's bargaining, we also put in a part-time job guarantee, which you might think, well, who cares, because we're talking about not that many hours. But things keep changing when we talk about the industry, and when you start seeing things like self-checkouts, and you start seeing things like third parties, contract workers come in, or temporary foreign worker come in, it becomes pretty important to even make sure that those jobs don't get taken away and moved away. And so we got a part-time job guarantee in that too. We also have hour guarantee language that talks to for part-time workers that they are guaranteed some level of hours. And this is important, and I know that Unifor as well, in their Metro bargaining, had been able to get some hour guarantee language that goes in there. In the Loblaw sector, we have it in a department where, depending on if you're in the top 25%, you get guaranteed the maximum hours, and then it tiers down. So we built a system which ensures that for part-time people who want them, because we also have availability systems where people can indicate what they want to be available for, that they're also going to get hours. Because frankly, you could get paid $20 an hour, and if you get 4 hours a week, you're not really getting that far ahead either. You need to be able to get hours in order to work. That fundamentally means something, and so we were able to achieve it. In our Metro agreement, we've had for some time hour guarantee language too. It works on a slightly different model where it's based on your length of service. So the longer you've been there, the bigger guarantee that you get of hours of work, which again was fundamentally mirrored with Unifor in their collective agreement as well. Scheduling is a major issue, and you know, we've spent some time working on it. We spent a lot of effort leading into the bargaining, working with the company. I think if we had just left it with trying to negotiate scheduling language, we'd probably still be sitting there with them today. And so even though we got the 2-week schedule out of the Loblaw's deal, we maintain scheduling language, and we frequently meet with the employer to review how these things work so that we can have that ongoing discussion and make it as good as possible as we can for our members, right? And I briefly touched on automation. So one of the things that we've been doing, you may have seen Loblaw's has a system now that they call Click and Collect, where you can order your groceries online and then you show up and get them. We've put language in place to ensure that when that system happens, that that's over and above the regular store complement, so that doesn't replace the workers who are there. We have seen that with the self-checkout model, which I love, because you know, when we talk about automation, it's not really automating anything, it's just convincing you folks to work for free for Loblaws or Metro or people, which I think is a wonderful trick that the banking industry and the gas stations did to us too. We have seen that that model really doesn't work. Even though they tried to cut back on store hours for that, our experience has been that it really doesn't work. Consumers don't like it. It doesn't work that well. And so what we've also seen now with Loblaws too, partially as a PR tactic, but also because it fundamentally means something and it's important to a consumer's experience, is now they're advertising hours of the day where they have all tills open. What a crazy idea. You could go in and maybe get your groceries through the till instead of standing 10 deep behind the one till that's open. And that just talks to a consumer and the public's need and want to really deal with people and really get a valuable, good experience, and our workers provide that, and we're starting to see the employers respond to that. So that's a pretty good thing too. We also have minimum wage language plus at our Loblaw agreement, in our Metro Barn agreement we put that into. We have a drug card that we rolled in for Loblaw. So again, when you talk about those drug costs, you've often, if you even have a drug plan, often you have to pay and then get it reimbursed. And what we experience with our members in places that have those plans is often they don't feel they can afford to pay up front. So having a drug card really means something to those people. It means that they can get those drugs that they may need for whatever medical condition that they have. I see I've got the big hook coming for me, folks, so I'm going to try to do this quickly. But one other major point I wanted to talk about that is certainly true is we have seen that there was a big push on the industry to spread it out. The employers tried to spread out our collective agreements, It's one of the most major important factors, I think, that we achieved in that Loblaws bargaining is we drove our disparate collective agreements together into one big collective agreement. And we saw functionally, even in that set, what happens, because we had a collective agreement that covered just the Windsor area. Some of you may recall that the Windsor area went out on strike. And the difficulty with that was the rest of the province didn't. So it really limits your bargaining power and your, and that is a, you know, as a tactic, one of the few tactics that workers have to stand up for themselves. If only one poor pocket of the province can go out, that causes a problem. So we've now successfully driven those collective agreements together. So when we do it, we're doing it more so as a provincial collective agreement and not regional pocket agreements, which will provide for far greater power for our members when we get into future rounds of Loblaw bargaining. Most of the threats, like you say, were covered. I want to just, last thing, Mark, I promise, and then I'll go. when we talk about automation, I would really like you all to consider that, because I've got an iPhone, I've got all kinds of nifty computers and gadgets, and I think it's really easy to think of these things as solutions to problems. Many of you may have seen Amazon put out their little cute commercial about how great it would be to saunter into a store and grab stuff off the shelf and walk out. The Amazon Go model that they look at. Well, what they're really talking about there is stores where, again, they're having you do the work for them for free. They're talking about three employees in there, and I don't think it's a functioning great model. I think people actually want people to provide a service to them. If their retail and experience with people had no value, then farmers markets would have gone away a long time ago in favor of just the supermarkets, in favor of the new markets that we see, like the city market stores, which 1006A was able to get in there. So think about those things when you go and do that. It might seem interesting and fresh and neat at the time, but take two steps back and think about what the actual intent is. And the actual intent is to not provide you, the consumer, a greater service. It's to provide Amazon more money and not have to pay people and not have to employ people. So that's it. And with that, thank you kindly.